Today's program is brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons, third-generation cure masters producing the country's best dry-cured and aged hams, bacon, and sausage. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
I'm Linda Palaccio, host of A Taste of the Past. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you, as always, from the back of Roberta's Pizza here in Bushwick, Brooklyn. You're listening to The Farm Report, and I'm your host, Erin Fairbanks. When I'm off air, I work as the executive director of Heritage Radio Network, and on air on The Farm Report, talk about issues facing farmers and food producers and consumers across the country. Today is no different. We are joined on the line by David E. Gumpert to talk about his new book, The Raw Milk Answer Book, What You Really Need to Know About Our Most Controversial Food. David, welcome to the show.
Well, glad to be here, Erin.
I am excited to talk about this. I want to say right off the bat and on the record, I am a heavy user when it comes to milk. I drink a fair amount of it, and the raw milk conversation is something that has popped like on and off my radar over the last couple of years. And I'm excited to learn a little bit more about what drew you into the conversation. Why is it you decided to spend what I can only imagine has been a great chunk of time putting together this book?
Yeah, if you had asked me that half a dozen years ago, I would not have told you that I expected to be spending that much time on raw milk, because I didn't even really know what raw milk was. I grew up in the city and always drank pasteurized milk and didn't even know people were drinking raw milk. And I actually spent a lot of time writing about small businesses, entrepreneurship. I've written a number of books about how to start a business and how to plan a business. And I came across some examples beginning in about 2006 where the FDA and state agriculture agencies were going after small farmers who were producing raw milk. And, you know, it was a revelation to me, as I said, that they were producing raw milk and a lot of people wanted to drink it. But it was also a revelation that the government was trying basically to put these small farms out of business. And, you know, as someone who had spent a lot of time writing about small business, I had never seen a situation where the government was trying to put small businesses out of business. I mean, we have something called the U.S. Small Business Administration to promote small business. We have Heritage, and it's part of the American dream to start your own business and get wealthy and independent. And so this was just a total revelation to me. I still am astounded when I see the government trying to put these enterprises out of business. I mean, we've already, even apart from the raw milk, we've lost close to 90% of our small dairies since 1970, just as a result of consolidation and big corporations taking over more and more of the dairy business. So the problems facing small dairies aren't just a function of raw milk, but you know, raw milk offers an economic opportunity to farmers, and to see the government trying to basically pull that rug out from under small operators was pretty upsetting to me.
Well, so I suppose we should clarify for folks what we're talking about when we talk about raw milk. Is it as simple as there's pasteurized milk and there's raw milk, or are there other categories that we should be thinking about?
Well, most fundamentally, it's as you say. There's pasteurized milk, which is milk that's been heated to about 160 degrees. And it's also almost always been homogenized. And then there's milk that hasn't been processed at all. Now, as you suggest, there's a little more to it than just that distinction. As part of raw milk, I mean, if you were to take raw milk from a conventional dairy, you would be well advised not to drink that milk. It's not just if you would want to drink raw milk, you want to drink it from a dairy that's committed to producing it raw and that has experience producing it raw, because raw milk can be dangerous, can be risky if it's not produced safely. And dairies that produce milk for pasteurization are not as safety-oriented, just because they don't have to be. You know, the milk is going to be zapped, and that zapping kills off any threatening bacteria, and so they don't have to think as much about it. That isn't to say that they many of them don't try to run a sanitary operation, but it's not as urgent for them as it is for the dairy farmers who are producing it as intended raw milk.
Intended raw milk. Well, yeah, and I would say I do know, like, production for the conventional kind of distribution chain, farmers are rated, and I think there are some, like, pay variations based on the cleanliness of the milk.
They're encouraged to produce clean milk.
Yeah.
But it's not life or death.
Right, exactly. So, well, one of the things that I want to kind of unpack a little bit here, because something I think about a lot with regards to milk is, you know, we have this idea, you know, milk has these like broader kind of symbolic implications. And I think regardless of what type of milk you buy, when you go to the grocery store and you pull that, you know, gallon jug off the counter, I think it's interesting that there's actually quite a bit that has happened to that product in between, you know, when it came out of the cow and like when it's hitting, your cereal bowl. And you mentioned, you know, the pasteurization, which is the kind of heating of the milk, which is, I think, one of the kind of primary concerns as it related to raw milk. And within pasteurization, there's all different kind of levels and techniques. And, there's a whole kind of range there. And then similarly with homogenization, which is kind of making sure that the milk, like the butter fat, solids don't separate, and that's what you get when you buy non-homogenized milk that has that, like, you know, chunk of cream at the top. One of the things I was really surprised to find out is that, and something kind of interesting I think to think about as you go to from like whole milk to 2% to 1% to skim, is kind of remembering that is additional layers of processing that the milk is going through to remove those butter fat solids, which are then being sold into the cream market or for, you know, ice cream or butter or other dairy products. And then also that sometimes with skim milk in particular, there's actually an adding of dry milk powder back into the skim milk. And I only kind of go through some of these examples in an effort to say, like, when we're talking about milk, I think there's a real kind of spectrum of things that we're talking about. So I think it's helpful to kind of put some boundaries. And you illuminated some of those when you're talking about, you know, milk safety and raw milk safety, that we want to make sure that we're starting a conversation talking about folks who are producing for a raw milk market. So I'm wondering, in that landscape, milk words you hear a lot, organic, grass-fed, pasture-raised, you know, do we need to further put boundaries around the raw milk conversation as far as, like, safety is concerned or best practices are concerned with regards to production of raw milk and some of these other kind of metrics that we use to identify different production practices?
Yeah, well, you're helping explain why I wrote the Raw Milk Answer book, because there's so much confusion around raw milk and milk in general. You mentioned organic milk. I mean, there's a lot of confusion about organic milk, and I've met people who say, you write about raw milk. Gee, when I go to to Whole Foods, I make sure to buy organic milk. Isn't that raw milk? And the answer is no, it isn't raw milk. It's almost always, unless it's labeled as such, it's milk that's been pasteurized. And for the most part, organic milk tends to be ultra-high temperature pasteurized.
Exactly.
In other words, it's pasteurized at a higher temperature than ordinary pasteurization. The reason that happens is because there's not enough organic milk generally available in certain regions, so it gets transported around the country, and in order to keep it from going bad, they subject the milk to this higher temperature pasteurization, so it will last longer without going bad. And so, I advise people to, you know, if they're trying to decide between just getting regular pasteurized milk or let's say conventional milk that's been pasteurized or organic milk that's been pasteurized, I would advise just going with the conventional milk for the most part, because the organic milk will have been pasteurized to such an extent that any remaining enzymes and proteins and the desirable parts of the milk will have been damaged and really of no use anymore.
Well, I think you're touching on, you know, there's like the trade-offs with any kind of product for individual consumers, you know, whether we're making our purchasing decisions based on kind of our health priorities, like the taste or flavor profile, you know, cost priorities and access. Like there's a lot of different factors that go into the choices that people make and are able to make at the grocery store. So I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you know, why you think that, you know, you mentioned at the top of the show that you were surprised by the government's, you know, and when you were speaking about government, I suppose we should probably clarify who you mean by that. We're going after these small-scale milk producers. But before we get into those details, maybe you can give us just a touch of history about, you know, why we started pasteurizing and why now it seems like we're kind of revisiting this conversation. Is it a new conversation, or is it something that's just kind of bubbling up into the more popular media?
It depends kind of on how broad a look at history you want to take, but let me just try to summarize it very quickly. You know, for about 3,000 plus years up until about the mid-1800s, milk was generally fine. I mean, you know, we were a rural society, whether it was, you know, the U.S. or Europe or Asia, and so milk tended to be consumed directly from the animals in local communities, and it didn't present any problem. In fact, if you look at the Bible, you'll see a number of references to milk always in a very positive kind of a way. You know, the land of milk and honey, and that kind of thing. You know that the writers were talking about raw milk; they weren't talking about pasteurized milk. And but beginning in the 1800s, when particularly in the U.S., when the Industrial Revolution began, people began moving from the country to the city, and in really large numbers, millions of people. And so they wanted their milk in the city as well. And there were cow owners who tried to satisfy that need and didn't do a very good job, and they often weren't honest about it. And so we had basic, really our first feedlots in places like Brooklyn and in Philadelphia and Boston. We had large numbers of cows that were crammed together. They were often fed the leftovers from distilleries, so they were malnourished. And we didn't have any understanding about sanitation and the dangers of disease, and so there were, and we didn't have that understanding regarding other contaminants like water or horse manure, and so people were often there were outbreaks of serious illness like typhoid and tuberculosis, and you often had large numbers of children involved because they are the large consumers of milk, and so they would get sick in large numbers, and there would be even widespread deaths attributed to the bad milk they were getting. People didn't understand exactly why the milk was communicating disease, but you know, whether they didn't understand, for instance, that many of the people who were doing the milking were sick themselves. They didn't understand that the cows were being malnourished. You know, they didn't understand about refrigerating milk or and those kinds of things. So from about 1850 to about the early 1900s, we had a really serious problem. And a number of big cities, including New York, Milwaukee, Chicago, Boston, began requiring pasteurization of the milk in their cities as a way to deal with this public health problem. And pasteurization had just come into acceptance in the late 1800s. And so that began to be seen as the solution to this problem, rather than let's clean up the production. Pasteurization became the solution, and it became, as you suggested earlier, became a huge industry. And it is a huge industry today. It's something, I've seen estimates of something on the order of $130 billion industry in the U.S. So you're talking about a big business. The fractionating of the milk, which you referred to, and the pasteurization and the homogenization and the production of other products like ice cream and cottage cheese and all those kinds of things are all big business. And so this requirement of pasteurization began to be, by the 1950s, states were beginning to enforce that and adopt it. I would just point out that when people talk about milk safety today, they're not talking about the same problems that we had back then, except that there's this hugely strong tradition in the public health arena, in the medical arena, to see those original problems as continuing to exist problems, so that the public health people worry that somehow we're going to fall back to those, you know, those dark days of the late 1800s and early 1900s. And the reality is that the diseases that people get today from raw milk are the same as what they get from other bad food. We've heard of incidents involving, you know, bad cantaloupe and bad raw spinach and bad ground beef and even bad pasteurized milk. And when people get sick, they get one of usually four pathogens. And it's the same thing that when people get sick from raw milk, that they get one of those four pathogens. They don't get typhoid, and they don't get tuberculosis, and they don't get brucellosis, and all those really horrible diseases of the past. So it's confusing because of this history, and this history had really took a terrible toll on people at the time, but it also has left a terrible legacy.
Well, you know, so I want to get into this a little bit more. It's interesting, in prepping for this interview, I came across a website, which I'm going to assume is on your radar, called Real Raw Milk Facts.
I refer to them in my book.
And you know, I was looking through some different components of that site, and one of the areas that I thought was most interesting is I put together a collection of position statements. And if, as you scroll down the list, you're seeing a lot of big names, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, you know, and then others that may be less familiar, the National Mastitis Council. And, you know, I didn't have a chance to read through each and every statement, but the ones I tapped into were, you know, kind of across the board, taking the stance that folks should not be drinking raw milk. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about, you know, why, despite kind of such a, like established organizations taking a strong kind of like no position on this, is this argument kind of like not going away? And I think one of the things people often point to is like, oh, the, you know, kind of like the science and the facts. And when you started tucking into this, what were you finding? I mean, were things as clear as like this particular website makes them seem, or not really?
Well, I mean, I think that site, the Real Raw Milk Facts website, it should be noted that it's run by people who are against raw milk.
Which is not at all clear.
No, it's not clear, and I think that's why
also,
I pointed it out.
Because, yeah,
it's really, let's put it this way. It's kind of typical of what happens in this whole arena, and that's part of why I wrote my book, because everywhere you turn, if you're someone who's looking to get information, straightforward information about raw milk, and you plug in raw milk on Google, you're going to come up with places like Real Raw Milk Facts, whether it's pro or con, and they all have a slant, and they all have a position to take, and the Real Raw Milk Facts site is an effort to appear objective when it's really not completely objective.
Well,
now, having said that,
I agree with you.
They have some very good information there.
Can I just share? One more thing I want to share before we continue is that I was also surprised to see that the website is sponsored in part by a law firm,
yes.
Marler Clark, that does primarily like food poisoning, you know, work around kind of foodborne illnesses and food poisoning. And again, just, you know, knowing kind of the source of the information, you know, it changes, I don't know how you're kind of receiving the stuff. So I just want to like share that too before you continue, but go ahead. You were saying?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'd say I was going to say it's typical of a lot of what happens, but I'm not sure typical is quite the right word, but it's indicative of what you find in this arena, which is a lot of organizations, a lot of people with their own kind of slant and their own particular take, which is often a controversial take. They're either against raw milk, or they're for raw milk, or they're promoting raw milk, or they're promoting really pasteurized milk, and they're I think there's an argument, and part of why I wrote my book is I think there's an argument to be made on either side, and I try to present both of all those arguments and explain them, and so Real Raw Milk Facts, as you suggest, is tends to focus on examples and situations that kind of prove, as it were, that raw milk is not safe. They have examples of people who've gotten sick, and they make a huge display out of those situations. And I just don't think it's necessarily, I think while they have some good information there, especially some of the data they have, they've gone and really gotten inside the data. Part of the problem with this whole arena of raw milk is that the data is very difficult to examine in a clear way. It's presented both by the government, you mentioned the CDC or the FDA, in a confusing way, and it's presented by pro raw milk people often in a confusing way, and it's very. I've tried to, and Real Raw Milk Facts has gone and done some of the better analysis of the data. Now you have to get really deep into it to appreciate that, and you have to kind of go through all the things you referred to, all the anti raw milk statements by the medical organizations and the dairy organizations and so forth, but they do have some good data there. And but the challenge with this, with even with the data, is you have to kind of do it yourself. It's nobody's going to do it for you. Nobody does it really in a clear and kind of understandable way. I like to think that I'm the first one to do that, really, in a way that's not necessarily trying to, promote one side or the other. But when you do it that way, you find that, at least in my judgment, that raw milk isn't as risky as, say, a place like the Real Raw Milk Facts site would make it appear to be.
Right, and at the same time, it's challenging as a consumer when you're on a website watching a video, you know, where parents have a young child who's become sick or, you know, has died or, you know, like the...
They haven't died. I mean, and that's one of the things. I mean, they all, and I think it's important to point that out. That's one of the kind of, I'd say, the, emotional slogans that gets thrown out here, is that, raw milk can kill you.
Can kill you, and you'll die.
You go back, and just in the last 30 years, there have been two people in the last 30 years that even the CDC will say it's only two people who've died, and they died from bad raw milk cheese, which isn't even legal under FDA regulations. There aren't any deaths really from fluid raw milk. In the last 30 years, there have been, just in the last 2 years, there have been 5 deaths from pasteurized milk. And if you go back a few years more, you find more deaths from pasteurized milk. I don't mean to, I don't suggest in my book that pasteurized milk is more dangerous than raw milk. It's just that if you're going to understand kind of what's been happening, you need to really make more sense of the data than the many of these sources will do it for you.
Well, and I do want to spend some time in the second half of the show talking about what are the reasons that people are kind of interested in drinking raw milk more generally. But we need to take just a short station break. So hang tight. You're listening to the Farm Report, and we'll be right back.
You are listening to Chillin' Bat by RecTech. This is the Farm Report on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
The following program was brought to you by S. Wallace Edwards & Sons. Edwards Suriano hams are aged to perfection for no less than 400 days and hickory smoked to achieve a deep mahogany color. The Edwards name is well known for its world-class aged and cured meats. Their exclusive curing and aging recipe produces a unique flavor profile that enhances the quality characteristics of Berkshire pork. Optimum amounts of pure white fat marbling contribute to a flavor that's a delicate, perfect balance between sweet and salty. For more information, visit edwardsvaham.com.
Hello, this is Mark Ladner from Del Posto, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And we are back. We are talking about the Raw Milk Answer book, written by our guest, David Gumpert. And we spent most of the first half of the show kind of lightly touching through some of the reasons that why this controversy remains so interesting. And what I would love to hear from you now is kind of looking from the raw milk enthusiast side, what are the purported benefits and what did you learn in the research of your book about the validity of those benefits?
Well, just to kind of make an important point before I explain that. The CDC says any number of times that there is no difference in terms of the health benefits between raw milk and pasteurized milk, and they emphasize that, no difference. And that has turned out not to be true. And the reason I say that is that we have now have about half a dozen studies, mostly out of Europe, that suggest very strongly that raw milk imparts benefits, especially to children. It imparts protection against asthma and allergies. And these are two very serious autoimmune issues for growing numbers of children. So, and I think there have been, even before these studies were done, there were anecdotal suggestions, people saying, well, you know, I drink raw milk, I've been drinking it for a number of years, and I'm healthier. My immune system seems to be stronger. My kids don't get as many colds. So there's always been kind of that part out there, but now the studies are beginning to come out and corroborate some of that. So I think that's one of the reasons that more people are taking to raw milk. I think the other part of it is that people are, in general, are looking for more locally produced food. They're looking for more nutrient-dense food. They're looking to consume more raw food in general and more unprocessed food. And so you get pasteurized milk, and that kind of falls into all the categories. It's a processed food. It's generally not locally produced. It comes from, it's gone, it consumes a lot of energy. You go through all kinds of issues with it. And so it becomes kind of symbolic, as it were, for a lot of things that are taking place right now, and a lot of the shifting concerns and the shifting desires that people have around food. I mean, there's a revolution going on in the food arena. When you look around, you realize just how profound it is. I mean, beginning with the popularity of the Food Network, and all the way through all the different diets that are becoming the paleo diet and all the different similar kinds of variations of that. There is a huge shift going on, and as a result of that shift, people are not only consuming more of the local unprocessed food, but they're consuming less of the mass-produced food. I mean, the sales of McDonald's are down, sales of Coke are down, sales of mass-produced cereals are down, and a lot of these companies that produce these foods, the Cokes and the General Mills of the world, are having a big, big challenge figuring out what to do, because right now they're having to shut down plants and lay off workers, and their stocks are declining, and so it's some big changes going on out there.
Yeah, well, it's been interesting. I've been reading Michael Pollan's most recent book, Cooked, and his chapter on air, where he's looking a lot at fermentation and bread and the history of the bread industry, to me brings up a lot of these, a lot of parallels around kind of what we do and what we don't know about what's in our food, and what we do and we don't know about what happens when you add these like different layers of processing to something. And I think what for me is a really interesting part of the conversation as it relates to raw milk is that you never want to, I've never want to be in a position where I'm discounting someone's personal experience. If you're a raw milk drinker and you love it and it makes you feel better, cool, good for you. If you drink pasteurized milk or whatever kind of a flavor that comes in it, because that is your choice, then like, cool, good for you. But I do think there's like something very interesting in kind of the bigger picture, I think, that you were kind of laying out there. It's like this idea of how, as a culture, we think about what we do and we don't know, and what is actually safe. Like, where do we kind of set these like demarcators? I actually had a tweet come in here from, NY Animal Egg. Says, at Aaron Fairbanks, raw milk is like water in Mexico. Locals can consume it, but others run the risk. And that is something that I've heard quite a bit, is that, you know, if you're a farmer, if you're used to drinking raw milk, it's okay. But for people who aren't used to it, it can be dangerous, as though there's like a, some type of like ramping up period or getting used to it period. And I'm wondering if you can, you know, talk for people who are interested in kind of approaching this. What is like a best practice way for them to do that?
Well, what I try to do in the Raw Milk Answer Book is to try to help people think about risk, because we all approach the subject of risk differently. And so for some people, as you suggested, I'm with you in the sense I respect those anecdotal stories. If people are feeling healthy from and they're drinking raw milk and they think that that's a factor, hey, that's you know, good for you. And I respect that. And I don't think it's I don't think you're making it up. I don't think it's just all in your mind. But that person is also really saying, "Hey, I think that the food I'm consuming can really have positive effects on my health." And there are other people who worry a lot, and instead of thinking about how whatever food it is, whether it's raw milk or locally produced meat or locally produced vegetables might be healthier or make them healthier, they worry that they may get sick because the food hasn't been, either in the case of milk, hasn't been heated, and that their kids could get very sick, and they may be like one of those mothers that are in those films you alluded to, and so on and so forth, and they go down a whole path of fear and nervousness. And I respect that as well. And I think for people who are worried about more the negative effects that food can have on their health, and those people should respect those feelings, and they shouldn't drink raw milk, and they shouldn't eat many of the other foods that maybe haven't gone through the kind of processing that is common in our food system. So I kind of try to approach it from that point of view.
One of the questions that came through in your press kit was, what if I want to feed my family raw milk, but my spouse doesn't? I thought it was so interesting that that was included. Is that something that's come up as like kind of interfamilial kind of discussions around milk choices?
Absolutely. It comes up a lot. In fact, it's come up to such an extent there have been cases where when spouses are having difficulties and separating or divorcing, where one spouse will threaten the other, "Hey, you're feeding the kids raw milk. That's child abuse. I'm gonna come after you on that." And that's a real tough situation. And there actually have been a few cases where public health people, medical people, have singled out raw milk drinkers or singled out the parents for feeding it to their children. And so it does have some real, it can get really ugly partly because of all the controversy around raw milk and because the government's attitude that we shouldn't be drinking it. So a spouse who's angered and looking for some source of retribution or whatever can really, you know, say, "Hey, look, the CDC says it's terrible and says it's dangerous and you should never drink it." And so I'm not sure it happens a lot, but I know of a number of examples where that has occurred. More often it's a situation where, you know, as I say, one spouse is saying, "Hey, you know, we have friends who are giving raw milk to their kids, and the kids, geez, they don't get sick like everyone else is. I'd like to, you know, let's start try it on our kids and see how it goes." And the other spouse will say, "No, I don't want to take that risk. It's too dangerous. Look at all the stuff the CDC says and the FDA says." And my feeling in that situation is to respect the spouse who has the concerns. I mean, I think there are, and I go through in my book, there are some in-between ways to begin to, you know, to compromise over that that sort of argument or disagreement. But I really take the point of view of respecting the concerned spouse.
Well, that's like another, that kind of like leads me into like what I want to talk about in the remaining minutes of our show here is the fact that the regulatory environment from a legal standpoint is very different between where the federal government stands and state governments and kind of what can and can't happen as it relates to raw milk sales. And I wanted to touch a little bit on this issue by exploring maybe the recent bill that's been brought to the House floor in Vermont, Vermont Rep. Teo Zagar introducing a bill that will make raw milk sales available at farmers markets or through CSAs versus just being sold on the farm. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the legality of raw milk and maybe using what's happening in Vermont as an example of how states are dealing differently with raw milk sales.
Sure. That's Vermont has been discussing raw milk on and off for the last several years legislatively. There have been a number of proposals. I actually testified last year on behalf of a change that I think you alluded to that allows it to be actually makes it available I think for delivery and at farmers markets, but under certain circumstances. It's Vermont is not not unusual in the sense that it is a complicated regulatory situation. Let me just start out by saying that raw milk or milk in general is regulated at the state level. So state the FDA, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, really only has power to regulate raw milk as it might go in interstate commerce. So it prohibits the transport of or the sale of milk across state lines. But within each state, that state has the power to regulate the milk. And so basically you have 50 states and you have 50 sets of regulations. It's that simple or that complex. So but what's been happening broadly speaking is there's been more and more of a move toward allowing raw milk within states, and in fact, this current legislative season, there is legislation to really loosen restrictions or to allow raw milk where it's currently prohibited in 18 states. I think last year it came up in 23 states, in most places the legislation dies, but usually in each year, and I think this year being no exception, in two or three or four states, the regulations will be loosened. And because these proposals to loosen the regulations don't usually make it the first time they're proposed, or even the second time. It's like anything else, just like gay rights or whatever. It has to come up, you know, over a number of years before enough legislators become accepting of, you know, whatever it is. And so in Vermont, not an unusual situation, except I'd say maybe it's a little more complicated than a lot of places, but you have a two-tier system in Vermont, and there's one tier for the smallest dairies that allows them to operate with fewer regulations, but they're limited in terms of how much milk they can sell. I think it's something like 87 gallons per week or fewer. And then for the tier one, then tier two is for the more advanced dairies or the larger dairies that want to go through meeting additional requirements like testing their milk, and they can sell up to 40 gallons a day on the farm, as well as through delivery directly to the consumers and at farmers markets. Now there's the new proposal in Vermont would add a third tier to the whole thing. So I wonder about, just because it would make it more complex, but one of the changes would be that these tier three producers would be actually be able to, in some cases, sell raw milk at retail, which would be a huge change in Vermont because it's only been available direct from the farm or for delivery at farmers markets. But so this would be a big change, and there'd be now the three tiers, and that's, you know, distinguished by how much milk they can sell per week, and so on and so forth.
That sounds like setting up quite a bit of work for the regulatory agencies.
For the regulatory agencies
state.
And for the farmers.
Yeah.
The farmers as well, because now they have to, you know, they have to have documentation to show the regulators if they come in, well, how much milk did you sell each week? Let's see. Did you go over the, you know, the 70 gallons or the 87.5 gallons? And you know, you have to document it and so on and so forth. So it's a bear. And actually Vermont is unusual that way. Most states don't have limits on how much can be sold, but Vermont seems to use that. I mean, I asked the question, you know, if you're going to allow raw milk, why put a limit on how much can be sold? I mean, you either allow it, you're saying it's, you know, it can be sold safely, or you don't allow it, and because it can't be sold safely, but or produced safely. So it's kind of an in between approach they've taken, which I'd say is questionable.
Yeah, well, I would say, you know, in our conversation today, we've probably unpacked more questions than we've provided answers for. And we've only really been talking about fluid milk. I mean, we haven't even talked about kind of milk as it relates to, you know, cheese.
We haven't talked about cheese. That's a huge area. And raw milk cheese is becoming more and more popular. And that has a whole another level of regulation around it, because the FDA does regulate cheese across the country, regardless of interstate commerce. So it has rules. Actually, they're pretty simple. But cheese that's produced with raw milk has to be aged at least 60 days. And so that eliminates some of the soft cheeses that France and Quebec are well known
that other people get to enjoy. Well, I think it probably makes sense to end in a similar spot to where we started, which is talking about, you know, I think the real need to support, you know, dairy, small-scale dairy in particular, medium-scale dairy. I think in so many ways, I know here in New York State in particular, the dairy industry really provides a lot of the infrastructure for producers of all other types of agricultural products. And I think that if you know anything about the history of dairy in the Northeast over the last couple of decades, it is not a happy story. So I'm excited to see more people, you know, discussing what's going on and looking at innovative ways to support the dairy. And I definitely encourage folks to check out your book and form their own opinions and get the answers that they're looking for as it relates to raw milk. David, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really great to have you on, and I really enjoyed the conversation.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Aaron.
So you've listened to another half hour, bridging on 45 minutes of the Farm Report. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. If you missed us live, you can catch this and all 39 of our great weekly shows on iTunes or Stitcher. Definitely click that subscribe button. If you have something to share, leave a message. Hit me on Twitter. It's Aaron_Fairbanks or Heritage_radio. Would love to hear from you. Thanks so much for listening. Stay tuned in.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.